very good Friday and welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer, your host with you here today on Good Friday. Coming up in today's show, Taylor Charlstrom has a report about the importance of calibrating your orchard sprayer. Ashton Carr will report on a new genetically modified purple tomato for Fresh Market. I'll have a check-in of national agricultural news, and we'll start off with a look at regional ag news right after this.
Do you know the nutrient use efficiency people? Yes, I'm talking about the folks at Verdesian Life Sciences that deliver crop insights and solutions so California crops grow to their full potential. From micros with a proprietary delivery system to solutions that help improve the uptake and assimilation of applied nutrients. Visit VLSCI.com to learn more about Verdesian solutions or to connect with a local representative right here in California.
In regional agricultural news, sales of Easter lilies are up this time of the year, but according to growers and wholesalers, they are below pre-pandemic levels. The pandemic 2 years ago pretty much wiped out 70% of the sales of lilies that were being grown in the greenhouses in California to sell for Easter. That according to Bob Miller, who grows Easter lilies at the Del Norte County town of Smith River. He says the demand for plants from the greenhouse to the retail stores has never recovered fully. The reasons, Miller said, are that buyers are afraid to overstock their stores. As with Christmas trees, Easter lilies lose their market value the day after the holiday, and that younger generations are not as religiously observant as their elders. This Easter, there basically is not a big increase in the orders for the product from greenhouses to stores, even though last year stores cleaned out their product very well. He said they sold the product well, but did not place much in the way of additional orders for plants this coming Easter. The lower demand from greenhouses, he adds, has led to oversupply of bulbs, many of which never got the chance to bloom as a result. So then you either dump or plow down the crop that is unsellable, and he says that is very expensive. For more than a decade, the Almond Board of California has recognized the need to invest in the future of agriculture in the state by supporting the California Future Farmers of America Foundation scholarship efforts. Since 2016, ABC's fundraising efforts have been led by members of ABC's Almond Leadership Program. More than $200,000 has been generated through an annual golf tournament, live and silent auction during ABC's annual Almond Conference, plus other donations and events during that time. With a generous donation from CUSIFI, the 2021 ALP program raised more than $50,000 for FFA scholarships, of which $33,500 were awarded to 17 high school students at the 94th annual FFA State Leadership Conference in late March. FFA members intent on pursuing careers in agriculture, not just the almond industry, are eligible. Over the past year, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has stepped up support of specialty crop producers and local and regional food systems. USDA believes specialty crop producers are integral to the food system of the future, and they are working to improve available options for specialty crop producers as well as ensure equity in program delivery. The Risk Management Agency rolled out a new insurance option for small-scale producers who sell locally, which is named MicroFarm. This new insurance coverage option simplifies record-keeping and covers post-production costs such as washing and value-added products. Information is available now, and producers can learn more from an approved insurance provider or an RMA specialty crop liaison. In addition to MicroFarm, RMA rolled out another new insurance option this past year, including one for California citrus trees. The Farm Service Agency also offers pandemic assistance for organic producers. The new Organic and Transitional Education and Certification Program provides assistance to help cover losses of markets, increased costs, labor shortages, and expenses related to obtaining or renewing organic certification. The Board of Supervisors have signed off on an agreement between the Riverside County Office of Agriculture and the state for ongoing efforts to detect the presence of pink bollworm species in cotton fields. In a 5-0 vote without comment, the board authorized Agricultural Commissioner Ruben Arroyo to renew the compact with the California Department of Food and Agriculture, retroactive to November 1st and ending on June 30th. The Pink Bollworm Host Free Monitoring Program contracts are renewed on an annual basis. This new one provides for $5,000 in state funds for county agricultural inspectors to watch for any signs of bollworm resurgence. In October of 2018, the U.S. Department of Agriculture declared publicly that the pests have been completely eradicated from cotton fields after more than 100 years and tens of million dollars in yearly control costs. According to federal officials, the first bollworms arrived from Mexico in 1917 and became rooted in Texas thereafter, spreading to other parts of the country. After 2003, they were mainly found in Arizona, California, New Mexico, and Texas. The pests feed on cotton seeds and destroy fibers, potentially ruining crop yields, according to researchers. In Riverside County, there are roughly 6,700 acres reserved or dedicated to cotton production, according to the Office of Agriculture. The cotton fields are clustered in the eastern portion of the county around Blythe. The cotton industry nationally represents a $30 billion market, according to USDA. Seasonal variations in E. coli outbreaks of field-harvested romaine lettuce have long been observed, but little understood. One theory suggested that the pathogen was present in the environment greater in numbers at certain times of the year than others, notably the end of the growing seasons in California and Arizona. New research from USDA's Agricultural Research Service indicates another cause for seasonal variations in bacterial outbreaks. One of the most significant findings of this study is that E. coli survived on average 5.6 times better in cold-stored packaged romaine harvested in the fall than on the same varieties harvested in late spring, that according to an ARS press release. Another factor was a rate of deterioration in the lettuce. The deterioration rate of the variety with long shelf life was significantly greater when harvested in the fall than in spring, according to ARS geneticist Ivan Simcoe with the Crop Improvement and Protection Research Unit in Salinas, California, and co-author of the study. He says great deterioration in the fall lettuce was associated with better pathogen survival. While E. coli prevalence in the environment may also be involved, the results strongly indicate that fall harvested romaine and the microbe communities it harbors have intrinsic characteristics that make them a better place for E. coli to survive in fresh-cut product. That according to study leader and ARS microbiologist Maria Brandl with the Produce Safety and Microbiology Research Unit at the ARS Western Regional Research Center in Albany, California. She says these are areas they want to work on. For example, is this something they could try to manipulate in the long run through plant physiology and breeding and microbiome engineering? And would this trend be observed for E. coli survival in the field? The observations definitely open an entire new branch of inquiry about outbreak seasonality.
Sponsored by the California Walnut Board and Commission, delivering value to growers and handlers with advocacy, research programs, and walnut promotions. Doing more together.
Sprayer maintenance is one of the most important steps a grower can take going into the season to ensure they get the most out of their crop protection inputs. And with so many uncertainties facing tree nut growers these days, getting top value out of crop inputs is critical. One money-saving strategy that UCCE farm advisor Franz Niederholter said growers should consider is to separate calibrations for different times of the year depending on the canopy. The practice, which involves increasing ground speed early in the season when canopies are light and slowing during full leaf out, can provide significant savings in labor, fuel, and water.
Making sure that you've got your air movement that carries the pesticide through the canopy, air movements match to the particular orchard you're in, and that's mostly based on ground speed. 2 miles an hour is a good starting point. You can check the air movement through the canopy with flagging tape at the top of the tree, but ground speed is the most critical, and it's also important to get the spray volume targeting where the canopy, especially in older trees or walnuts, tall walnuts, you need to aim high with most of your spray volume to get the coverage you're targeting where your target is. Aiming the water at the spray volume at where your nuts and your leaves are.
Depending on the nut crop a grower is spraying, the type of calibration will also differ.
Your target, the time of year, the amount of surface area you're trying to cover changes dramatically between, say, walnut bloom and a cover spray for mites and worms later in the season. So you your gallons per acre, that as far as efficiency goes and costs, labor costs are up, and you don't want to be spraying more than you have to time-wise. So if you're spraying with 100 gallons, where you could spray a little bit less, or if you you're spraying the volume that targets the your matches your target, it's going to give you the most efficient application. And you want to get that material, you want to get complete coverage through the canopy. As you mentioned, material costs are up, so you don't want to have to come back, pay double for the job. So you kind of be careful with how you make the application that give you the best opportunity to get these results you need.
Properly calibrating a sprayer could see savings as far as inputs go, but Niederholzer said the real savings comes from just a proper spray in general.
An ineffective application means you're possibly getting some damage coming through. You're getting having to come back and clean it up. So you're avoiding a good job the first time avoids any damage that comes about from a poor application and the need to come back again. So that's really where you're going to see the major results of a carefully calibrated sprayer is you get the job done and there's no having to come back. You may save yourself a little bit on material, and that's always valuable. Ground speed, if you're driving at the speed you need, time is money. If you could speed up early in the season, that's going to put some money back in your pocket. But the real value is avoiding loss and damage that's going to come right off your gross.
In the last few years, a flurry of new technologies have been coming out to make the spray process easier.
Robotic sprayers, effective, functional robotic sprayers. At least one company is building them here in California. You can set the speed, and it's going to stay at that speed. You can set the nozzles, and they'll stay there. There's ways that makes sure your job is dialed in. There's no mistaken accidental shifting of slipping a gear here and there, or your RPMs change a bit and you're dialed in. They can also track where you go, so you know that you're not skipping a row or doubling, getting some phyto because you sprayed the row twice, or running some issues with too much material. Your MRLs could possibly run into trouble if you double spray a row that you're spraying in the middle of the night, and an applicator might mistake a row, but a robot's not going to, because it's going following GPS and it's going to go exactly where you want it to go. So there are the real potential advantages for efficiency with some of these new systems that are coming out.
There's still room for improvement in these systems, and Niederholzer said we'll see even more advancements in sprayer systems in the future.
The current systems, the current basic systems are you've got a robot, they're driving at a set speed, they're driving every row, they're not missing something, that it's mixed by a pro whose job is just to mix and load. There are systems out there now that are LiDAR-based that can measure density of canopies and shut off when there's nothing there. So that improves the efficiency, especially in older orchards or young orchards where you've got a lot of gaps. So that technology is coming along, and it's with the LiDAR, you can adjust the rate. So that is out there, and it's just at the very beginning stages, but it's commercially available, and I think that's going to help you with MRLs. It's going to help a grower who's looking to be in all markets, and if your sustainable label is critical to your marketing, that's another advantage. So there are multiple small contributions to a better overall outcome is what this technology can bring.
There's giant potential sleeping in your soil. Under drought conditions, it's never been more important to wake it up. Phycoterra, a superior soil microbial food, activates the native microbes responsible for your soil's health and water-holding capacity. Adding Phycoterra to your crop increases water retention up to 10% and optimizes crop nutrient availability. Plus, it delivers excellent mixability and application flexibility, making it easy to add to your existing crop input strategy. Visit phycoterra.com to learn how you can wake up your soil's giant potential with Phycoterra.
In national agricultural news here today, new data from USDA's Economic Research Service shows quick service restaurants recovered faster than full service restaurants from the initial impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. Consumer spending at both full service and quick service restaurants initially fell following the onset of the coronavirus, with noteworthy differences between the two. Before the pandemic, consumer spending at both quick serve and full service restaurants was near or slightly above the previous year levels. As of March through May of 2020, spending at quick service restaurants had dropped to about $20.1 billion, 15.4% lower than average spending a year earlier. Full service restaurants experienced a more severe drop during this period, likely related to the mandates limiting in-person dining across most of the country. Spending fell to $7 billion, 51.7% lower than a year before. Quick service restaurants recovered faster than full service restaurants, with spending surpassing previous year levels for the past 4 months of 2020. In contrast, by the end of 2020, full service restaurants retained a 24.8% drop in year-to-year spending. Farm Journal Foundation is partnering with the Zoetis Foundation to launch a new program to find solutions for relieving student debt in the veterinary industry. The effort's long-term goal seeks to address shortages of veterinarians to work with farmers in rural areas. The new Veterinary Debt Solutions Program will convene leaders from across the livestock, academic, nonprofit, and veterinary sectors to address barriers that veterinarians face in building long-term careers in rural areas. High levels of student debt combined with comparatively lower rural salaries and demanding workloads discourage many young and diverse professionals from specializing in large animal veterinary science and entering the workforce, partially in underserved rural areas. The veterinary profession is currently experiencing an urban-rural divide, with only about 10% of final-year veterinary students expressing an interest in working with livestock after graduation, according to survey data from the American Veterinary Medical Association. As a result, about 500 counties across the U.S. now face shortages of veterinarians. USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack this week announced the first in a series of grants designed to support and expand rural health care facilities. USDA Ag News reporter Rod Bain.
The first in a series of USDA Emergency Rural Healthcare Grant Awards have been announced.
We're awarding $43 million in grants to 93 rural healthcare organizations and community groups across 22 states.
With Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack Wednesday observing,
these investments, if you look at the 22 states and the hospitals and clinics that are being assisted, will benefit about 2.2 million people who live and work and raise their families in rural America.
Projects covered under the Emergency Rural Healthcare Grants range from implementation of telehealth and nutrition assistance programs to facility renovation and medical supply purchases. The secretary recognizes the timing of this support for the nation's rural health care system.
Since 2010, 135 rural hospitals have closed, and another 453 are very, very close and vulnerable to closure. 62% of rural hospitals don't have intensive care units.
More grant awards are expected to be announced in coming months. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Representing 35 countries, rice farmers, millers, researchers, and other allied industry members will meet in Cancun, Mexico for the Rice Market and Technology Convention, May 31st through June 2nd. It will take place at the Hilton, Cancun. The conference has seen a large early registration from companies not only from throughout the Western Hemisphere, but from other corners of the rice world marketplace. Marcela Garcia, president and CEO of the U.S. Rice Producers Association, cited the market conditions caused by the COVID-19 pandemic and current world events as key incentives driving the interest in this year's event. A special seminar titled Follow the Money, Closing the Rice Milling Profitability Circle, featuring the highly regarded milling engineer Norris Bond, will take place on May 31st, just prior to the conference opening reception. The conference features an array of talented speakers on a variety of subjects, beginning with popular economist Dennis DeLaughter, who will set the tone for the conference in his presentation titled The Law, Unintended Consequences, Embracing Change. Other speakers will address sustainability and retail markets, rice grain quality, Central American market developments, and the impacts of higher agricultural input values and competitive pricing on the rice sector, among other topics. For more information, log on to ricemtconvention.com. That's ricemtconvention.com. President Joe Biden's decision to allow summertime E15 sales on an emergency basis does more than increase sales of the higher blended fuel, according to the ethanol industry. Renewable Fuels Association head Jeff Cooper says there's not a megaphone much bigger than the Oval Office.
When the president of the United States is embracing ethanol as a tool for lowering pump prices, that is absolutely helpful in putting our issues in front of the everyday consumer and helping them understand that gasoline with higher blends of ethanol is going to save me money.
some 25 to 30 cents a gallon for E15 versus E10 gas. But myths that E15 can damage engines are dying slowly, another reason that Cooper says Biden's action helps.
We've driven tens of billions of miles on E15 without any incidents, without any complaints, without any reports of engine damage. So I do think this helps really engender trust in the use of the fuel and the benefits of the fuel when you've got the administration putting its support behind it.
And sales of E15 were already headed up, hitting a record 815 million gallons last year, key to dealing with crisis like the war in Ukraine.
And I absolutely think the current situation, the tragic situation in Ukraine, is underscoring for the American people again that we are not energy independent. We need to do everything we can to enhance our energy security and reduce our dependence on petroleum.
A strategy that would have been hurt this summer had the president said no to an E15 emergency waiver, but that Cooper says now needs a permanent fix for future summers. In support of Executive Order 13985, Advancing Racial Equity and Support to Underserved Communities, the United States Department of Agriculture has made its Equity Action Plan publicly available. The plan outlines actions USDA will take to advance programmatic equity to improve access to programs and services for underserved stakeholders and communities. All too often in the past, USDA programs and services were designed to benefit those with land, experience, money, and education, while leaving behind those without means, resources, or privilege of one kind or another. Over the course of decades, congressional reports, internal data, civil rights investigations, court actions, and stakeholder testimony have documented this long history of inequity and discrimination. At the start of the Biden-Harris administration, USDA took swift actions to analyze data and consider a wide range of diverse stakeholder input and prioritize activities that are immediately responsive to the urgent needs of those who have historically had difficulty understanding or accessing USDA's programs and services. To craft this equity plan, USDA first assessed and identified key challenges and opportunities through analysis of data and robust stakeholder engagement. Concurrently, USDA convened with staff and leaders across USDA components to learn together and evaluate systems, practices, and policies that hinder progress. USDA mission areas and staff offices have identified challenges and opportunities of particular focus. The USDA Equity Action Plan highlights a set of actions USDA will take to advance equity. These particular actions are highlighted in the plan because of their potential high impact for underserved farmers and ranchers, families, children, and rural communities. Some of the action items that they will be working on include partnering with trusted technical assistance providers, reducing barriers to USDA programs and improved support to underserved farmers, ranchers, landowners, and farm workers, expand equitable access to USDA nutrition assistance programs, increase USDA infrastructure investments that benefit underserved communities, advance equity in federal procurement, uphold federal trust and treaty responsibilities to Indian tribes, and institutionalize an unwavering commitment to actions towards ensuring civil rights. As USDA makes progress on the goals and actions, the department will partner with the Equity Commission on their future recommendations in line with the best practices in the private and nonprofit sectors. USDA is also focused on creating an organization that places diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility at the center of how they support USDA's workforce and performance.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
The purple tomato is a genetically modified organism that's really a part of the first generation of bioengineered fruits and vegetables. We got to catch up with Kathy Martin, who is a professor at the University of East Anglia in the UK, and Nathan Pumplin, who is the president and CEO of Norfolk Healthy Produce, a stateside subsidiary of Norfolk Plant Sciences, to hear about their involvement in making the purple tomato and taking it to market. First things first, we hear from Kathy about how the idea for a purple tomato became a reality.
I was involved in a collaborative project, a European collaboration project, which was interested in increasing antioxidant capacity in tomato for health benefits. And because pigments, which is what I'd worked on before in terms of colouring, flower colouring, because I knew how to regulate flower pigments, these anthocyanins, which are the blues and purples that you see in nature. And they're good antioxidants. I proposed as part of this project that we would increase the amount of anthocyanins in tomato, because tomato fruit don't normally contain anthocyanins. And that was way back around 2003 or something like that.
Now, purple tomatoes don't just appear out of nowhere. Like we discussed earlier, this is a bioengineered product. So what does this growing process look like?
Actually, the process of making the fruit was pretty minor relative to everything else. But we used two genes that act as switches to switch on anthocyanin biosynthesis. They do this naturally in tomato, but not in fruit, so that the very similar genes are operational in leaves, switching on anthocyanin production in response to stress. We took two genes from snapdragon and expressed them fruit specifically, so specifically in the fruit of tomato. And that took about a year to build the constructs and do the transformation. We weren't very good at tomato transformation at that time. And then we saw, it was over Christmas, we saw this. We had some little tiny plants and they were developing and they had unripe fruit and they looked perfectly normal. And then slowly, just over the Christmas holidays, they went purple, which was just fantastic. And so that was way back, maybe that was 2004. It took us quite a long time to be able to publish that. And that was published in 2008 after we'd shown that there were health benefits. And then down the line, if you want to get a GMO product onto the market, you have to have it in a commercial variety. So we had to do a lot of crossing and get it into varieties that were better. And we had to get regulatory approval. First of all, notification from FDA in the States that it's safe. And we're still waiting on that outcome. And also approval from USDA that we can go ahead and grow it without restrictive limitations on where it can be cultivated and where seed can be sold. And so that's what we're hoping to get pretty soon.
Nathan also gives us some insight as to how the purple tomato actually makes it to market, in particular to U.S. markets.
There are surprisingly few products that are made with bioengineering that are on the market right now that are fresh produce. And so I think there's not yet a standard process that these products make it to market. There's a lot of reasons why that is, but we're in many ways inventing some of that process as we go through it, but of course, following the lead of a few products. So one of the early ones that went through is from a company called Calgene that was based in California, and they made the famous Flavor Saver tomato back in the 90s. And this was popular with some people at the launch, but ultimately not a commercial success. And that was the last GMO tomato that the only one that ever got to market. It was off fairly quickly, and we will be the next. So Kathy sort of mentioned there's two main key regulatory areas that need to give approval. One is the USDA, so that we can grow the plants not under containment, and we can actually sell or provide the fruit to consumers. And the other one is the FDA, who does a regulatory process around biotech foods. And so both of those are in process right now. The last piece, which is really critical, is if you want to bring a new product out to market, even if you have all the regulatory approvals, of course, there's an extremely complex supply chain that's required to get anything out to market, and especially to get products, produce of the quality that we're all used to when we go to the store. So I'm actually speaking to you right now from Berlin, Germany. I'm at the Fruit Logistica meeting, which is a global produce industry meeting. And it's really fascinating just to see the diversity, of course, of produce, but the specific problems that have to be solved to get, you know, the foods, whether apples or bananas or tomatoes or potatoes. We just kind of take it for granted that we can go to the store and find those, but it's extremely complex. And so those are the pieces that we're putting together right now to bring the purple tomato to market. Kathy mentioned you need to have the purple trait in a really good variety. We need regulatory approval, and then we need the supply chain that can get really fantastic produce to consumers.